I asked Dan to play that tune to set this up. The tune is from the movie First Contact, which is in the Star Trek series. And it's about the first contact of the human race with a species not of this earth, an intelligent species. And that stirring melody occurs throughout the film. And I loved it when I first heard it, the melody. I knew I wanted to use it one day in worship. But the film is set in the year 2063. However, it's interesting that recently some very authoritative people in the area of astronomy and the universe have made a suggestion that it's going to happen a lot sooner than that. Seth Shostak, a senior astronomer in Mountain View, California, not long ago gave a speech to the people of NASA in which he said that he is absolutely confident that we are going to receive radio signals from an intelligent species by the year 2040. 2063 is 47 years from now, but 2040 is only 25 years from now. That's within possibly my lifetime, which excites me, actually. Now, when this statement was made, there were two religious responses that were radically different, like radically different. The first was from Brother Guy Castellamagno, who is the head of the Vatican Observatory, and he responded that he thought this actually could happen not 25 years from now, but tomorrow. He said he didn't think any intelligent person would be surprised that it happened. He expects it, and what he said theologically for him is that he's certain that the God who evolved us out of natural elements could certainly do the same thing with the natural elements in another world. That was his take on this. But the fundamentalist evangelical Ken Ham, who runs the Creation Museum down in Kentucky, very harshly disagrees. He states there can be no other creatures in the universe because God made us to be alone in the universe, and people like Shostak and Castellamagno are in rebellion against God. And even if there were extraterrestrials, he says, intelligent other beings, God would send them burning in hell anyway. Now, Shostak is saying something that's not new, of course. All the way back in 1966, the remarkable Carl Sagan, whom I personally revere, saying exactly the same thing as Seth Shostak. He was perfectly clear that finding intelligent extraterrestrial life is inevitable, completely inevitable. But he also said something that neither Ken Ham or Castellamagno said, and that's this. When that happens, it will change absolutely everything in our civilization. Everything. Fundamentalists like Ken Ham are going to rant in denial. Apocalyptic preachers are going to multiply, warning us all, trying to make us afraid. Wall Street is going to do a roller coaster dance it's never done before. And religious teachings are going to be clutched onto tighter or tossed. New cults will mushroom. All the schools are going to have to reprint their textbook. It's going to be a complete change of everything. Now, I rather agree with Sagan, even though he was writing long before Shostak, and even though the world has changed a lot since 1966. The discovery of intelligent life outside of our system, outside of our Earth, does seem inevitable. And such a discovery will change everything, and it will be huge. Whether it's fast or slow makes no difference. And billions of people on this earth will resist it with all they have. Because change, whether it's good, terrible, or neutral, says Rosabeth Cantor, who teaches about change at Harvard University, always means something that human beings of every culture seem to find horrifying, and that is a loss of control. Too much uncertainty all of a sudden. It'll make us queasy. It'll shock us and surprise us. We may fear a ripple effect. If that kind of change can happen, what else can happen? More changes on the way? Oh no. We'll have to work a lot more to keep up, to figure out what's going on. We can't just go along the way we always have. We're going to have to really think and focus. Some people may be terrified because they've read history and recognize that whenever an alien group of people, like people from Europe, come over to a place like what we now call the United States, we do terrible things to the people who live here. And maybe people will say, well, maybe people will do terrible things to us now, these other people. And the sheer impact of it is going to be far greater, I think, than when Copernicus or Galileo announced to a nauseated Europe that the planet Earth was not the center of everything. It really upset people when they said that. You have no idea. And when someone, way before Sagan, actually suggested the possibility of intelligent life on another world, that was the famous Dominican Italian Giordano Bruno. He was also a Unitarian, by the way. He preached the unity of God, and he was against the idea of hell. He was immediately burned at the stake in Rome in the year 1600 in the Piazza dei Fiori, the Square of the Flowers. That's how irrational resistance to change can get, killing somebody. Now, I know about change a lot myself because I'm in the midst of it right now. As you heard, I just retired from decades of being a congregational minister. The changes have been immense for me, and they have not been easy. The structure in my life has disappeared, and I've discovered you have to have a PhD to even begin to understand Medicare. This congregation also has gone through a lot of changes. I'm very well aware of that. A beloved ministry of many decades has ended, and there's been a lot of other staff changes, and frankly, it's not that long ago when this congregation used to meet in people's living rooms instead of this absolutely gorgeous building. In a very short period of time, there's been a lot of change, much of which has been very good, some of which is perceived as a little frightening, all the staff changes and so forth, and I understand that. I get to watch my own congregation go through all these changes. There's an interim minister who I really love, making all kinds of changes, changing things that I put into place. I'm watching that happen, and I think it's good, actually. But it's emotional, certainly. But it's inevitable. Change is inevitable. At the very least, we don't live forever, and so that's going to, think change is going to happen every way. Even if a minister stays here 50 years, eventually it ends. So this idea of change is really deeply taught by the various religious teachers, ranging from Mirabai in India. She used to sing these amazing songs about change. The Gospel of Mark, it makes it very, very clear. Change is part of the way things are. This farmer doesn't know how it happens. The farmer just plants the seeds and watches it comes up. Doesn't understand the process. He just knows that it's change. Day in, day out, day in, day out. You put the little seed in, eventually it's harvest time, then you put more seeds in. Constant change from day to night, from morning to evening. Buddha also said that. Heraclitus, the Greek philosopher, said, you can't put your foot in the same river twice. Because the river is always flowing. Time is always flowing. I think it's significant that the parable of Jesus and the Buddha both basically say, this is the way it is. Don't try and pretend it's any other way. all sense of permanence is an illusion, an absolute illusion. There is no such thing. Even we ourselves are not permanent, Buddha said. His first words that are recorded for him to have said in his own language of Pali are anatta, which means no self. What it means is that even we are not permanent. We're different in the morning than we are in the evening. We're different when we dream. We're different when we're 12 years old than when we're 52. Which is the real us, the 12-year-old or the 52-year-old? Or the 89-year-old? Or the baby who doesn't have a language? It's all supposedly us, but how different from one moment to the next? So, you know, this basic idea of change is universal, is an old religious teaching. Doesn't prevent us from helping change to happen, however. Since change is inevitable, I think it's okay to work with that inevitability and to make changes that we see need to be made about our social world and about ourselves. I was raised in Detroit in an Italian-American family. I was raised in the white world, and I was raised with the concept of racialization. No one ever taught me anything about it, but it sunk in. Race is something that was created. The first person to use the word was Immanuel Kant. The construction of race in the United States was entirely based upon a deliberate decision made in the 1600s after a particular battle that happened. And it's a total artificial construct with no biological reality. And yet, racialization, that's the word by John Powell from Columbus, racialization exists in all of American society, both amongst people of European ancestry and people of African ancestry, and Asian ancestry, and Latino ancestry. And our calling, it seems to me, as religious people, is to resist that with all of our heart in ourselves and in the social world around us, and to help make changes happen that are positive, not negative. Change is inevitable, but we can help steer it in a positive direction. And we have. When I came into the ministry, I'm sorry, no gay people were welcome. I was told that very clearly. All of us were told that when we were back in the 1970s. There was no UU congregation that was willing to call us. They weren't quoting the Bible or anything like that. They were culturally bound to not like it, to be afraid of it. What are the neighbors going to think if we called you? That's what they would say to us. Well, we worked hard, a whole bunch of us, to change that. And now that's not an issue anymore for most of our congregations. And I served one of our largest congregations for many years quite happily. It was not an issue. But we made that change happen. It didn't just happen by itself. And I think we need to applaud the fact that we can make such changes, and we can do that for an even larger issue, such as the racialization issue. So, you know, Gautama, the Buddha, said a lot of this kind of stuff earlier. He talked about the universality of change, the illusion of changelessness, the control that we can't ever have. And the story of Shingebis that you heard earlier talks about some of the things that people try to imagine have to be permanent, such as not moving, or such as moving down to the south. That's what they've always done. We've always done it this way. It gets cold, the north wind blows, we go south. Shingebis says, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to figure out how to stay here in the cold. Looks like we're all the great-great-great-grandchildren of Shingebis, because here we are and there's snow outside and it's kind of warm. She was very courageous in the story, but I'm not sure that courage is the issue here. The Buddhist teacher, Pema Chodron, talks about resistance to change as shenpa. That's the Tibetan word. And she translates it so we can understand it as being hooked or being stuck. She says it's with us every day. And what she's trying to say, the resistance to change is based upon our experiences in the past. Somebody scolded us when we were a child. An ordinary scolding, nothing evil, nothing terrible. Come in out of the rain. What's wrong with you? Why are you getting wet? You're all muddy. What's wrong with you? Well, we feel those kinds of things. It's not a big thing. But then when somebody looks at us a funny way or criticizes us, raises an eyebrow, in the modern day, adult years, all of a sudden, that little childhood feeling comes trotting out, and we try to escape the discomfort of the present moment. And the way we do that, she says, because it happens all day long, every day, the way we do that is to assign to certain things a capacity to comfort us, to make all that discomfort go away. And, you know, she makes a list: food, alcohol, drugs, sex, work, shopping, all that stuff. We can do it too much, and we assign the power of these various things to keep us from changing. We find comfort in these things. But that comfort, too, is an illusion. It's not real, ultimately, except maybe it is partially. I had a conversation with a psychologist named Amy recently who reminded me that all of us are raised with predilection for comfort because we actually don't sleep on beds of nails, we sleep on mattresses. And we don't eat food we hate, we eat food we like. We call it comfort food, as a matter of fact. And so all of these things help take the edge off when we're discomfortable. But then she talks about competing commitments, Amy does. Competing commitments. And this is a phrase worth meditating on. I'm committed to giving away a lot during the December holidays, gifts to family and to friends, to charities and so forth. But then, you know, on the 26th, when it's all over, I'm exhausted and worn out, and I want comfort. So I make a dish of pasta this big, because that'll make me feel better. I can lecture myself about willpower, how I shouldn't be doing that, and should be eating a big bowl of raw, undressed kale instead. But the fact is, I'm committed to two things. I'm committed to health and to comfort. I'm committed to giving things away, and I'm committed to taking things for myself. Double commitment all through our lives. And our job, partially as spiritual, religious people, choose your word, is to think about those two things and disentangle them whenever they get too tightly wound. There's no magic bullet here. Buddha and Jesus and Mirabai and so many religious teachers taught that you have to have a kind of a daily practice. You have to think about things every day. You can call it meditation if you want, but you have to do something to bring you back to focus, to make you more conscious, to make you more aware, to not let the habit of going toward the comfort automatically keep you from living your life more fully. So, you know, we all get hooked. I fight being hooked every day. Darn it, I'm a good cook. I can't help it, you know? I like to cook, and I enjoy my food. But I have to think about that every single day. So here it is. Change is permanent, both good and terrible change. It's never going to suddenly stop. We can work with it, opposed to pretending it's going to stop. We can make changes in the world. And I want to point out that Buddha talked about nirvana. Now, he didn't say nirvana. He said nibbana in his language, and we say in English nirvana. And nirvana is not heaven, never was. It has no connection to the Western concept of heaven, eternal bliss. Nibbana means to blow. Not like the north wind in the Shingebis story, but like you blow over a hot soup to cool it down so it can nourish you. You can't eat it when it's too hot. You have to blow on it. And Buddha talked about that's what we have to do with our life. We have to blow on the hot stuff that's inside of us. The word shenpa technically means fuel, because it talks about that heat, this being hooked. It's heating us up. And to live a good, healthy life, we need to cool ourselves down. And that's nibbana, that's nirvana. And Marla's letter adds another thing. Her father was a farmer, just like the guy in the story, and the story that Jesus told. Marla is not a farmer. Marla's life is totally different from her dad's, her late dad's. Totally different. But what she's thankful for is that her father gave her some ideas that were good, to work hard, to work, to love your work, to be proud of what you've done. And she can still do that, even though her life has changed drastically from what her father's life was like. The principles can go forward. They're going to look different in each and every generation. And Unitarian Universalists have actually rewritten their principles a number of times because they recognize that what words work in one generation are not going to work in the next generation. That's pretty wise, I think. Nothing lasts forever. So when some signal comes from the star Tau Ceti around the year 2040, or earlier, as Brother Casella Magno suggests, and we learn that we're not alone, well, the change is going to be great. But maybe if we start blowing on the hot soup now and start looking and focusing on how change affects our lives and how we can't control very much, when we hear about this radio broadcast, we can simply say, so what else is new? Big change. May we move forward from this day empowered with fresh and new forms of grace and gratitude and compassion for self and for others, and be energized every single day to come in our work of unhooking ourselves and living more fully.